Welcome to the first virtual alumni book club of 2010. I'm Jay Lenro, alumnus of the class of 1973 and an officer of the Alumni Council. We are here in the Matin Center on the Homewood campus in the Digital Media Center as we await the beginnings of a massive winter storm that may drop as much as 2 feet of snow on campus. Hopkins sophomore Buddy Sola is taping this talk today, and it will be available to you on the website in transcribed form as well. It is a pleasure to introduce our faculty host, Professor Andy Pekosh, who will discuss this month's selection, The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History, by John M. Barry. Professor Pekosh is Assistant Professor of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. His research interests lie in understanding the interaction of viruses with the respiratory epithelium. His efforts are focused on influenza A virus, the severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus, SARS-CoV, and Andes virus, a South American hantavirus responsible for hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, known as HPS. As you will discover by reading this book, the Great Influenza of 1918 killed between 50 and 100 million people worldwide, including some 675,000 in the United States alone. This influenza outbreak killed more people in 1 year than the various plagues of the Middle Ages killed in a century. The book covers the pandemic from three interweaving threads: the history of American medicine, where Hopkins Hospital played a major role, the spread of the virus from a farm in Kansas, and the medical community's race to analyze and treat the disease. Professor, thank you for being with us here today.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Could you share two passages that you believe are representative of the author's writing and discuss why you chose them?
Sure. The first one I'd like to read comes from chapter 15. Many histories of the pandemic portray the eruption of deadly disease, the hammer blow of the second wave, as sudden and simultaneous in widely separated parts of the world, and therefore deeply puzzling. In fact, the second wave developed gradually. When water comes to a boil in a pot, first an isolated bubble releases from the bottom and rises to the surface, then another, then two or three simultaneously, then half a dozen. But unless the heat is turned down, soon enough all the water within the pot is in motion, the surface of roiling, violent chaos. In 1918, each initial burst of lethality, isolated though it may have seemed, was much like a first bubble rising to the surface in a pot coming to a boil. The flame may have ignited in Haskell and set off the first burst. The outbreak that killed 5% of all French recruits at one small base was another. Louisville was still another, as were the deaths on the city of Exeter and the outbreak in Switzerland. All these were bursts of lethal disease, violent bubbles rising to the surface.
It's an interesting analogy, Professor, that brings to mind one of the threads that you and I had a chance to discuss earlier, which was the way the political establishment in this country or any other country deals with something like this, because when those first bubbles rise to the surface, often it's not enough for a politician to see the need to act, whereas people like yourself, public health professionals, know that this is just the wave starting to build in ferocity.
Very true. That quote really captures the essence of dealing with an epidemic, particularly an epidemic like influenza, which has a short incubation period. It can spread rapidly across large swaths of land. The time to act is when you see those first boils, because that's when you have the most control over the course of an epidemic. But oftentimes people need to see that rolling boil. They need to see the situation in all its intensity before they want to act. And unfortunately, when it comes to infectious diseases and epidemics, usually at that point in time, there's very little that one can do with public health efforts to change the course of disease once it's really established itself.
Let's look at two recent examples. the Hong Kong avian flu epidemic, and more recently the H1N1 or swine flu this past fall, summer and fall here in the United States. How much better are we politically at reacting than we were back in 1918?
Well, I think that the fact that communication skills, communication methods are so advanced right now, we can really keep track of outbreaks like influenza outbreaks in almost a real-time manner. The H5N1 outbreaks that started to occur really around 2003 in earnest were important because they set the stage. They reminded us of how severe a disease influenza can be, because those H5N1 outbreaks really result in very severe disease in people who get infected. Very few people get infected, and that virus hasn't been able to spread from person to person. So in many ways, it was the bell that was warning us about what influenza could do. Because of those outbreaks, I think we established a lot of good public health measures and some good resources to draw on when the eventual pandemic came. And, of course, in 2009, that pandemic did come. And, you know, our responses to that have been very, very good in terms of what we can do with respect to following the virus, understanding the virus, understanding its spread. But it's also a pandemic where we have to see how it unfolds. It's very difficult to predict these things. There are a lot of parallels between 2009 H1N1 with respect to its emerging in 1918 with respect to its emerging at an odd time, the spring and early summer. This first wave sort of moving slowly through the population. A second wave that it did emerge come September and October, which led to a large number of cases, but not a severe disease as we saw in 1918. And now we're waiting to see what the next step of this outbreak is going to be in terms of whether there will be a third pandemic or a third wave of the pandemic, and whether or not this virus will change in some way, like the 1918 virus appears to have during its first 1 to 2 years in the human population.
One of the interesting notes from the book also was the thought that the government, even though we did have some communication, not what we obviously what we have today, but we had means of communication, newspapers in major and smaller cities around the country, telegraph, that the government did seem to do very little to let the general populace know that something was going on.
Yeah, and part of the issue that's usually brought forward about this is the fact that World War I was going on, and certainly there were some limitations on the press and what they could and could not report. But again, one of the fascinating things to me also is just the fact that there is this sort of this heterogeneity, this very different response to the pandemic between public health officials and in the general population as you move from city to city. Some places felt like it was just influenza and felt no need to prepare. Other cities earnestly prepared for a pandemic once they knew something was coming. Other cities, in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of people dying, still did not appear to find it necessary to put major public health measures in. So it's one of the interesting things about how different communities responded to this pandemic in 1918. And it's something that I don't think we saw in 2009 H1N1 because we're so interconnected now that the press was looking for these inconsistencies. Why can't we have one single message that goes out there? Because we can talk to each other and communicate so quickly and get one single message out there. And so any slight inconsistency between the messages was amplified now. Whereas clearly in 1918, there were lots of different ways to approach the pandemic, and depending on where you lived and who was responsible for the response.
It's also interesting to note that in 1918, Johns Hopkins Medicine was still a rather new institution, although it had already gained a considerable reputation, not only in this country, worldwide. And I guess we were 8 years removed from Dr. Osler creating the modern, what was then the most modern medical curriculum in the world. You mentioned earlier that you'd read the book for the first time before coming to Hopkins, and then rereading it and seeing the names on the walls and the portraits at the hospital, it had a slightly different meaning. You want to elaborate on some of that Hopkins connection?
Now, it's very true. I first read this book when I was on the faculty at Washington University in St. Louis, and obviously was very interested in it. When I came here to Hopkins 2 years ago, and started to see, well, right across my office at the School of Public Health is the William Welch Library. We have busts of William Welch as the dean of the School of Public Health. And that history really came through. So when I reread this book, it was with a completely different light, particularly the beginnings describing Hopkins as a medical institution and a public health institution, and how it was really right around this time that modern medicine was really established here in the United States in terms of the basic research component and the training of a medical faculty and a public health faculty. And in fact, it was interesting to hear one of the things that I wanted to really think about was I'd known that William Welch had gotten infected with the virus during this period of time, and so I couldn't remember exactly what his response was to the infection. But I did find that section here as we read through it, and I wanted to just read out a little bit of that part of this, which is from chapter 22. But as the train moved south, he felt worse and worse, perhaps suffering a sudden violent headache and an unproductive cough, a cough in which nothing came up and certainly with a fever. He would have looked at himself clinically, objectively, and made a correct diagnosis. He had influenza. No record exists of his precise clinical course. All of Baltimore, all of the East Coast was erupting in flames. The virus struck the Hopkins itself so hard that the university closed its hospital to all but its own staff and students. Three Hopkins medical students, three Hopkins nurses, and three Hopkins doctors would die. Welch did not go to the hospital. Almost 70 years old, 40 years older than those who were dying in the greatest numbers, having just left the horrors at Devon's, and knowing the enormous strain on and therefore the likely poor care, even at the Hopkins facility, he later said, "I could not have dreamed of going to a hospital at that time." Instead, he went to bed immediately in his own rooms and stayed there. He knew better than to push himself now. Pushing oneself after infection with this disease could easily open the path for a secondary invader to kill. After 10 days in bed at home, when he felt well enough to travel at all, to recuperate more, he withdrew entirely to his beloved Hotel Dennis in Atlantic City, the odd, tacky place that was his haven. So I read this and was a little bit disappointed. I was looking for more insights from him, especially when you think about the fact that he had just come, as it states there, from looking at the Army bases and seeing the tremendous mortality and the tremendous suffering that this was causing in a particularly young group of men, seeing what was happening in the cities along the East Coast at the time, and then realizing well enough on his own that he was suffering from the same symptoms that he just seen all these other people suffering from. I was really hoping to get a little bit more insights into what he was thinking, having just come from a situation, looking at that situation in a very clinical, objective way, and then realizing that he was now part of those statistics that he was analyzing. So it left me a little bit disappointed there, but something that I'll probably have to look into some more to see if there's any more information I can get about that.
Very good. The speed of this virus was what astounded me. One of the statistics that Barry quotes is that one in every 67 members of the armed forces, the American armed forces, actually died from this virus. And all those deaths occurred in a period of 10 weeks. That's astounding. How did this kind of vortex of the draft and the Army and the ensuing fall and the fact that we were in the midst of the early stages of a world war, how did that all mix in to help cause this epidemic?
Yeah, So there are several factors that really came together for this. One was the fact that this influenza virus really was a very different kind of influenza than what had previously been seen. Many of the doctors that seeing the disease initially thought this has to be something new, this has to be something different because of the presentation and how quickly this virus had spread in certain situations. So the virus itself had some interesting properties that allowed it to really take hold in the human population relatively quickly. And then combined with the fact that, you know, the U.S. was fighting a war, and it was in the process of shipping large numbers of soldiers overseas, first training them, of course, and then moving them over. And in those kind of environments that respiratory viruses like influenza just absolutely thrive in. We talk about there being a safety zone between 3 to 6 feet from an infected person, that if you're within that zone, there's a high likelihood of getting infected. If you're outside of that zone, you have a much reduced likelihood of being infected. So when you see some of these barracks of people just bed after bed after bed, right next to each other, within 2 to 3 feet of each other, hundreds of people in a room, it's just a situation that, unknowing to the medical officers at the time, was just perfect for spreading a virus like influenza.
Do you have any issues that you could single out that you think the readers would find interesting?
I think that looking at the what I like about this book is the is how the book brings together the multiple aspects of life that sort of factor into an epidemic. You have the personal responses, individuals themselves, how their daily routines are being changed. You have the public health responses, how do we protect the population in general? The medical responses, how do we treat people? What do we do with patients who are being ill? And then, of course, the political responses, which is, again, knowing there's a war going on at the same time, knowing there's an outbreak going on, not wanting to have too much fear be stoked in the population, yet relatively quickly realizing that they were facing a danger that was much, much greater than anything they'd experienced in recent memory. So I think how all those factors really play together is something that's very, very interesting, particularly now that we've gone through this 2009 H1N1 pandemic, which, of course, has unfolded in a different way. We've been very fortunate in that the virus hasn't mutated to become more deadly. But in many ways, there are some parallels here. It's attacking the younger population. It seems to be inducing severe disease in relatively young people who should be resistant to severe influenza. And it is spreading and has spread incredibly fast. If you think about the fact that in April, this infection was really limited to Mexico City and one or two cases in California. And since April, we've had the entire southern hemisphere be exposed to this virus. And now this past year, the entire northern hemisphere exposed to this virus. So it can move as quickly as previous influenza pandemics can. We've just been fortunate that we haven't seen that severe disease come through. And the politics of our response to this also comes into play. As we've mentioned a little bit before, I think that when we don't see a disease that causes that tremendous amount of mortality, we have a tendency to try to relax the measures that we're using to try to stem that infection.
I was struck not only by the politics of the political establishment and how they handled it, but the kind of the internal politics of medicine. And I guess you still have that tension today between among the doctors, the public health officials, and the nursing group. And Barry had a lot to say about how each one of them had their own turf. And as much as they were cooperating to battle this pandemic, they were also battling to protect their own portion of that medical establishment.
It's very true. I think sometimes the public has a perception that the medical establishment is one cohesive unit of people who have all been trained the same way and who perhaps all think the same way. When in fact, public health individuals look at diseases in very different ways from a medical doctor, from the nursing establishment. So I think how those pieces fit together is something that many people don't really realize how intricate those balances are and how different the approaches are there. Coupled with the fact that, I think sometimes people also think that all doctors have been trained the same way, so they will all respond to the same set of symptoms, to the same cases, to the same disease in the same way. When in fact, medical doctors as well as public health officials, we've all been trained, but we all also have our own thought processes or our own ways of analyzing a situation, and we often come up with different conclusions as to what should or should not be done. So there certainly is, especially in an epidemic that's just evolving, where we don't have all of our facts together, where we don't have all the information, different people will look at these situations and analyze them differently and therefore come up with different and sometimes contrasting opinions.
Do you see much knowledge of this among the new students entering the School of Public Health, or is it something that really their eyes are open to when they get there?
I think because of books like John Barry's, the knowledge of the 1918 pandemic is much, much greater now than it was, even, for instance, when I was trained in graduate school. So what I think is interesting is to see students come in now with that 1918 influenza experience in their mind and to have experienced a different kind of influenza pandemic. Most people who have lived through the 1957 pandemic and the 1968 pandemic do remember how serious a disease those outbreaks were. Certainly not in the same magnitude of 1918, but pandemics can be severe outbreaks and cause a lot of mortality and morbidity in the population. So I think a lot of them now see this epidemic as another sort of way to compare and contrast the two. What's different about this one in terms of severe disease, and then how this disease severity then impacts what public health measures we put in place to stem the tide of the disease.
What might our readers be interested in knowing about this book that we haven't touched on? What questions might they be asking themselves as they read the book?
Well, I think one of the interesting things to think about is the approaches of how the pandemic of 1918 was attempted to be minimized. Really, our only tool was public health measures, and we really did not have a very good understanding of influenza as a virus, how influenza was spread, what the disease time course was, what the time for infectivity, in other words, at what stage of the infection were you able to spread the virus to others? In the U.S. in particular, we had not had that medical research community in place to really have had much information about these kind of things. And so the responses there are very, very different from the kind of responses that we have now, because we've had 70, 80 years of medical research where we've investigated these kind of outbreaks. We know these details now, and we can come at these questions with, in some ways, many of the same public health measures. Again, in 2009, the H1N1 pandemic, we didn't have vaccines at the beginning. We were really basing most of our preventative work on public health measures. But those public health measures were very much more attuned to influenza because of the medical research establishment that we have here in the U.S., which is described at the beginning of John Barry's book and has really come to bear for this pandemic. So it's an interesting way to sort of look at this in terms of 1918 being the start of medical research here in the U.S. and how that same medical research institution that started then has now been brought to bear on a new pandemic here in 2009.
Hey. If I'm not mistaken, you need at least some semblance of the virus to create a new vaccine to combat that virus. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
So that means until you have this new mutated strain of virus in the early stages of an outbreak, there is no vaccine available.
Absolutely. And it's one of the issues that we always have with generating vaccines to influenza is I've talked before about we want to be proactive. We want to be able to act at early stages of an epidemic. But when it comes to generating things like vaccines, We are actually right now forced to wait for the epidemic to emerge so we can find that virus and then start to generate vaccines based on the virus that's emerging. And that puts us at a disadvantage.
What things do you think we've missed hitting on so far in our discussion? Anything in particular?
Well, again, I'll emphasize the fact that one of the reasons why I like this particular book is because of the interplay between all these different factors. I think that, as people read through this, they should try hard to work through some of the science that's in there, some of the politics, some of the more detailed things that are there, because it really does provide an interesting insight into not only how a virus can affect society, but how a virus can cause disease in people. And I think it's an interesting lesson to be learned.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. To our participants, please note that Professor Pekosh will be posting about 6 questions on our website for online discussion during the month of February, and we urge you to get involved. Also, if you do not have a copy of the book yet, please go to the Hopkins Alumni website and click on our link to Amazon and order it that way. Also, if you find this topic to be interesting, there are 2 other books that we could recommend. One is Flu, The Story of the Great Influenza Pandemic of 1919 and the Search for the Virus that Caused It by New York Times reporter Gina Colotta, and America's Forgotten Pandemic by Alfred Crosby. I thank you very much, and until next month, this is Jay Lenro, and again, Professor, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.